From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. Since childhood, Leonard Davis has straddled both the hearing and the deaf world. His parents were deaf. Though he could hear, he says he learned sometimes to approach life in ways a deaf person would. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we talk with Davis, author of the memoir, My Sense of Silence. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the season opener of The Sopranos on HBO, and film critic Henry Sheehan reviews The Mexican, starring Julia Roberts and Brad Pitt. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The online music swapping service Napster says it plans to install a screening system that will block its users from trading copyrighted music that's not authorized by the music industry. Napster lawyers announced the plan today in a federal courtroom in San Francisco, where a judge is deciding whether there's any way for the company to stay in business. Napster's being sued by the recording industry, which says the service encouraged its users to violate copyrights. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan spoke to the House Budget Committee today, and he repeated his support for some type of tax cut. NPR's John Idstey reports.
In testimony before the House Budget Committee, Greenspan repeated his view that the most important use of surpluses is to pay down the national debt. He also said again that projected surpluses are so large that a tax cut is advisable to keep the government from using the surplus to acquire assets like stocks and bonds in private companies. He said today that could adversely affect capital markets, reduce economic efficiency, and lead to lower standards of living. The Fed chairman added that one way to use the surpluses and preserve their contribution to the nation's savings rate would be to return them to individuals through private savings accounts. Greenspan suggested that could be done through mandated individual retirement accounts or through private accounts linked to Social Security. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. Navy says it's working with police in Germany and Sweden in an effort to track a hacker who broke into a Navy computer and stole source codes for a missile guidance program. The Navy says the hacker got into an unclassified computer at a Navy research facility in Washington. Officials say they believe the break-in took place in late December. The U.S. ambassador to Israel has warned that the Palestinian economy is on the brink of collapse and that this could lead to another explosion of violence. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Jerusalem.
Martin Indyk repeated numerous assessments that the five-month-old conflict with Israel may intensify further. Speaking to businessmen and diplomats, Indyk warned that Yasser Arafat's administration is disintegrating into semi-anarchy and gang rule. The United Nations has issued similar warnings and laid blame on Israel's policy of closure. This has blocked trade and barred Palestinians from entering Israel, leaving tens of thousands out of work. Ambassador Indyk urged both sides to curb insightful rhetoric, and he cautioned against the suggestion that Israel reoccupy Palestinian lands. Israel, he said, could not solve the conflict through force alone. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 16 points to close at 10,466 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 65 points, or 3%, to close at 2,171. This is NPR News. Former German Chancellor Helmut Kohl will pay a $140,000 fine to end criminal investigations into his party's finance scandal. He has 3 months to make the payments. Elisa Roth reports from Berlin.
Kohl has been under investigation for possible breach of trust charges. He has admitted to accepting more than $1 million in anonymous donations for the Christian Democrats while he was chancellor and party leader. The Bonn State Court, which made the deal, said that paying the fine is not an admission of guilt, but it did scold the former chancellor for setting a poor public example. Half of the money will go to charity, the other half will go to the public coffers. Kohl has privately raised several million dollars to pay previous fines for refusing to name donors. Closing the criminal investigation means that Kohl can no longer cite an open case as a reason for keeping the donors' names a secret. For NPR News, I'm Elisa Roth in Berlin.
President Bush said today that illegal immigrants from El Salvador may remain in the country for up to 18 months while the Central American nation recovers from two deadly earthquakes. The president met today with Salvadoran President Francisco Flores at the White House. He issued a statement pledging more than $100 million in aid to El Salvador over the next 2 years. Flores said the money will help restore basic services in his country, including water systems and housing. The two earthquakes left 200,000 Salvadorans homeless. President Bush is extending temporary protected status to illegal immigrants from El Salvador, allowing them to work legally and support families at home from their U.S. earnings. In stocks today, the S&P 500 lost 7 points. Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services and its employees working together in its Stop Hunger program on the web at SodexoMarriott.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. My guest, Leonard Davis, grew up in two worlds. One was the world of a kid from a working-class immigrant family in the South Bronx in the 50s. The other was the world of his parents, who were both deaf. In his memoir, My Sense of Silence, Davis describes what it was like to live between sound and silence. He writes eloquently of sign language, which he considers his native tongue. He says it's like speech set to dance, which can be crisp and clear or lilting and poetic. And Davis evokes the not-quite-silent atmosphere of his family household, the sound of his mother and father's distinctive voices, the furious slapping of hands as his parents had a fight in sign language in the next room. But his parents' deafness also cast a darker shadow across Davis's childhood. He writes that when he lay in bed at night, he didn't experience what many children feel, that sense of security and comfort, because his parents could never hear his cries. Leonard Davis is the head of the English department and a professor of disability and human development at the University of Illinois, Chicago. When I spoke with Davis last spring, I asked him to read this passage from his book, My Sense of Silence.
A child of the deaf may become hypervigilant. This is a word I heard used on the radio to describe soldiers returning home from war. They lie in their beds at night, hypervigilant. They wait for the bomb to drop, the shell to explode, the friend to drag his limbless torso into the trench. That was my experience of childhood. I listened for the burglars that my parents could not hear, for the robbers, the monsters, the flash fire, the crackling sounds of a ceiling collapsing. I was the guard, and it was all war. Last night I lay in bed listening to the mice running through a farmhouse where I'm vacationing. The lights were off, my wife was asleep. I lay in rigid awareness. When I hear sounds in the night, I still panic. My heart pounds. I never wake my wife, and I never woke my parents. I lie now, as then, in silent terror.
Leonard Davis, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you.
And thank you for reading. You know, as a first-time parent, I think my most terrifying thought was that I would sleep so soundly at night I wouldn't be able to hear my baby cry. Do you have those memories from your earliest childhood of your parents not being able to hear you crying?
I don't have specific memories, but I have kind of what Proust calls memoir involontaire. That is, like, I have bodily memories. I mean, I have even to this day a fear of being cold at night. I take extreme precautions so that I won't be cold at night. I have endless number of blankets that I keep around the bottom so I can pull up to cover me. And I have this sort of horrible sort of dread of death and separation even now when I turn the light out to go to bed. So I do have some memories, and I actually begin the memoir with a kind of memory of lying in the, because I was in the same bedroom as my parents, you know, inches away from them without being able to, in some sense, communicate with them as soon as the lights went out. I have the memoir begins with a kind of a scene of my parents making love, and I'm crying in bed and separate from them and together, yet together in a strange sort of way.
When you got a little older, though, did you work out methods for them to hear you, for them to know that you were in distress, like banging on the floor, something that would make a vibration that they could feel?
When I was in bed, I actually had my brother at that point. Later on, we were sleeping in the same bedroom together, and he was 10 years older. But he was a pretty good teenager, so he could sleep through almost anything. Once I became ambulatory, I could just go over to them. But I'll tell you one thing that's funny. Once when I was sick, I think I had the measles or something, that I was in bed for a really long time, I devised this kind of Rube Goldberg thing that I could call my mother in the kitchen, which was it was a one-bedroom apartment, and I was at least two rooms away from her, the bedroom, the living room, and then the kitchen. And I set up a series of strings that I kind of roped through the doorways and doorknobs and so on. I could pull the string and it would turn a light switch on in the kitchen.
So, did that work?
Not very well. but it was better than nothing. I think that was sort of the summary, better than nothing.
Do you remember realizing when you were young that you could hear and your parents couldn't?
I don't have a specific memory of it because I, growing up in a deaf family, deafness is not unusual, as it would be in almost any family with a disability or even any quirks in a family. So I wasn't really aware of it until I began to see other people's reactions to my parents. I think that was my sense of the beginning of a sense of difference. For example, when I would ride on the subway with my parents and they would talk to each other in sign language, everyone on the subway would stare at them. And at a very early age, maybe 3 or 4, I developed this sort of obsessive system of staring down each person on the subway, working my way from one part of the car to the other until they would stop looking. And then I would just begin at the top of the car again and start staring at them. So that kind of thing, or my friend's older brother said my father talked like an Indian. And I tried to attack him, but it was useless because he was about 5 times as big as me.
Now, you translated your parents' sign language. Were they eloquent talkers in sign?
In sign, well, I interpreted, yes, and they were sure they were as I mean, they spoke sign language the way that any normal person, any hearing person, would speak English. I mean, in fact, they were eloquent in a way that I didn't even realize because later, after my father died, I found letters that they wrote, and they were really beautifully written. And my father actually was a correspondent for a national deaf newspaper. He was a pretty good writer in English. And in sign, they were, you know, they could say great things.
But did they have their own style? I mean, well, everyone has a different style of speech, and some of us are better talkers than others.
Sure. My mother was probably more direct as a signer, and my father probably was more elaborate. Also, they were British, and both British, and so they came to America, and their signing was a sort of combination of British Sign Language and American Sign Language. So even now, for me, when I speak sign language, I'm always sort of saying the wrong thing because I have their sort of a kind of amalgam language.
You mean calling the bathroom the loo, or something?
Yeah, exactly. That would be the equivalent. Yeah, that's right.
You write that because your parents were deaf, there was a giant dictionary of sounds for which you had no names. Mm-hmm. What kind of sounds did you have no names?
Well, the one I write about particularly was something very simple actually, which I don't think I mentioned in the book, is pigeons cooing. I had no idea what that was for years. I couldn't figure that out. You'd walk away a building and there was this weird sound that came out of the building, sort of off the roof level. I had absolutely no idea what it was. It took me at least 4 or 5 years to figure that one out. And when I would go to sleep at night, there were these cats in the alleyway, because I slept over the alleyway where the garbage was kept, and there'd be constant cat fights. And I didn't know what those were, particularly the sound of kind of a caterwauling yowl, which I thought was an old lady who lived around the corner and would, you know, to me it was kind of like a witch-like lady. And I would listen to that, and then I'd look at her the next day and think, were you outside my window yelling that way? Things like that were confusing. Also, another extremely confusing thing was the Mr. Softy truck, which has a kind of little musical chime. I don't know if you have to grow up in New York, but there's this kind of little musical chime. And they started Mr. Softy when I had the measles, and I was in bed for 2 weeks. And so all of a sudden, I began hearing a music box just out the window at various hours, and I had no idea what it was, and I thought I was... thought this was kind of sent supernatural or something.
You must and I have thought you were mad.
Well, I thought that quite a few times.
Did you talk to your parents in sign language?
My parents used what they call total communication, so they both spoke and signed at the same time, and so did I. So kind of articulated and signed at the same point. My wife actually noticed something when she first met me, and I was, my father was still alive, and when I used to speak with him, she said, you know, you speak in a British Liverpudlian accent when you speak to your father, and I sound like a deaf British person, which I don't think I sound like normally.
So that's because your mother wasn't born deaf. She had spinal meningitis, and she was the one with the Liverpool accent,
right,
that she,
right,
retained when she,
that's right,
when she spoke after she lost her hearing.
Yes. She became deaf at 7. She had meningitis, and so she was one of those things that linguists are always looking for. She was born in 1911. So the language of a kind of working class Liverpudlian woman of that particular age is sort of preserved. It was preserved in her speech, because it hadn't changed since she came to America.
Now, what kind of signer were you? Were you a good one?
probably not. My parents, you know, this is common for children of deaf adults. It's something that we talk about at the conferences that we have. Some parents don't want their children to learn sign language at all. They want them just to be part of the hearing world. Others let them learn sign language quite adequately. My parents were sort of in between. And so I learned sign language, and my father certainly corrected me a lot. But I when I speak now, I can speak sign language. I can understand it. But I don't think I'm anywhere near as fluent in it or comfortable in it as a lot of other folks I know.
And they were ambivalent about it because they wanted you very much to be part of a hearing culture and not,
yeah,
a deaf culture.
Yeah, there are lots of deaf people who are very much, and my parents were very much part of the New York deaf Jewish community. But my father had a little difference. He was a race walker. He was held the unofficial record for the 25 miles, the American record. And he was a member of the 92nd Street Y team, and was actually, there are banner headlines in the New York Times from the 1930s of races that he won. So he kind of always fancied that he was more part of the hearing world than a lot of deaf people would. And he had hearing friends. So there was a way in which they really pushed me into the hearing world and said, that's your world, that's where you belong. This is, you know, the deaf world is our world, and you can be part of it, but you're really hearing.
I would think this being between two cultures, though, must be pretty bewildering, especially since it's so integral to something so integral to yourself, your language.
Yes, it is bewildering, and I think that there are lots of people like myself who don't know whether they're deaf or hearing, and in fact, we tend to think of ourselves as bicultural. I think I pretty much adapted a persona anyway in the hearing world until about maybe 10 years ago, and that's when I went to my first CODA conference, that's Children of Deaf Adults, and began to realize, no, there's this whole other side of me that I sort of suppressed in the effort to become a professor and somebody in the hearing world that uses English in a particular way, and that's when I began to realize how much of myself was really deaf and what that means to me, that deaf people there are certain ways that deaf culture works. And one thing is that deaf people are very face-to-face, very, very one-on-one with each other. When they talk, they look in each other's eyes. They look at each other's faces. Hearing people tend to look away when they talk. Deaf people touch a lot. They get intimate very quickly. This can be misconstrued by people who don't understand this. And it certainly was the case with me. People often thought I was, badly behaved or too forward or too blunt, and I think I still get that to a certain degree.
It sounds also as if in an effort to communicate, they bring more of their senses into the experience.
I don't know that that's the case. I mean, I think that's the perception that hearing people have about deaf people, because when you look at deaf people, they seem so mobile and animated. But they're just doing with their bodies what people do, what hearing people do with their voices. In other words, if I can say yes 10 different ways, and if I'm going to use sign language, I have to convey that yes in a different kind of way with my body, with my face, with my gestures.
When you sign, do you sign the way your parents did? Make the same gestures or those facial expressions or the sounds that your parents did?
Absolutely. And in fact, even when I don't sign, one of the things, my wife, it took her a while to figure this out, and my daughter is always pointing this out, is that when I'm angry or when I don't like the way something tastes or whatever, I get a very exaggerated look on my face of disdain or anger, which I have to explain. It took me a long time to explain to my wife. I'm not really overreacting. That's simply the way I do it. And you just have to know that that's the way a deaf person might show something on their face.
Leonard Davis, from an interview recorded last year. His memoir is My Sense of Silence. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an interview recorded last year with Leonard Davis. His memoir of growing up a hearing child of deaf parents is My Sense of Silence. Was your first word in sign language or a verbal?
My first word was in sign language, and it was the word for milk. My parents say that I had my little hands through the crib asking for milk.
What is that sign?
It's this.
Can you describe it?
Yeah. Radio's not very good for the deaf.
No.
It's actually, the way I do it is wrong. I mean, it's the sign language of my family. It's as if you were milking a cow, two hands going up and down, squeezing a little bit. But I think the actual method is in America is one hand just kind of squeezing together and unsqueezing.
Do you think then of signing as your native language? I mean, are there things that you can only say with your hands?
Well, let me put it this way. I'm a very verbal person, and I live in language. I write. Words are very important to me. I'm an English professor. I teach how to interpret texts. So that's a world I'm really comfortable in. But sign language is a whole other world, and there are ways it intersects and there are ways it doesn't. But when I sign, if I sign the word for milk, I feel more milky. You know, if I say the word for love, which is your hands crossed against your chest and you kind of push it and give yourself a hug, it feels more like love than just the word love. So there's a kind of intensity and there's a kind of childhood connectedness to these sort of primal words in sign language. And I often speak to myself in sign language, a lot of times when I'm driving, which is pretty dangerous. But I do a lot of driving, and I'll translate what I hear on the radio, you know, all things considered, or a music into sign language.
You write about the normal voices of the deaf. These are your words, how they're soothing, like whale sounds, cooing and arcing under the surface of the deep, too low for birds. I thought that was a really beautiful description. What were your parents' voices like that?
There is a kind of deaf sound. My mother had this Liverpudlian accent, and she'd say things like kooky and punch and lunch. She sounded like the Beatles, but with a slightly distorted sound. And the way I kind of describe it is like if you leave your hand in water for too long, and then the flesh begins to slowly change. And I think if you know a language and then you become deaf, things start to change a little bit. But she had a kind of high-pitched silvery sound to her voice, and I always found it very irresistible. She'd call me from the apartment building, and it was like this lasso, silver lasso, thrown out to me playing stickball or something, and I would just immediately come. Of course, I couldn't not come because I couldn't call and say no. But my father was much more gruff. He had a deep voice. He was gruff. He was kind of more of a gruff person, and he had a kind of scary voice to some people, and very scary to us when he was angry. But it was that sort of low, grumbling voice that would be difficult for a lot of hearing people to understand.
Now, your parents went to a social club for the deaf and often took you and your brother with them. What did it sound like there?
Oh, it was wonderful. Lots of sounds. There'd be kind of, you know, you could hear people. There were all kinds of grunts and groans, and you could hear people's false teeth chattering. There was just about as many different sounds as a human being can make without. And then sometimes they'd be very quiet, and you'd just see a million people standing around speaking in sign language and not much sound. We loved it. We used to run around, and we used to yell out loud, and nobody could hear us. It was great.
I would imagine, though, growing up, you know, in the 50s, it wasn't a great time for understanding or acknowledgement even of disabilities. Did you think of sign language, I guess, as a poor substitute for spoken English? I mean, did it cause you to adopt some of the discriminatory or prejudicial ideas people had about your parents, that they were less intelligent, that they were, you know, quote unquote deaf and dumb?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of work on sign language in the last 10, 15 years to show that it's a complete language, as complete and capacious and commodious as any language around. But yeah, in the 1950s, there was not a lot of understanding. There was no Marley Maitland. There was no National Theater of the Deaf. There were no TTYs. There was no captioning. I mean, being deaf was just kind of crummy from the point of view of accessibility and resources. And my parents were poor, and so they never went to Gallaudet, which was a college at the time, and their education stopped at sixth grade. So most deaf people, I think, did consider their language not really as good as English. But then, of course, you know, if you look at the history of English, you find out that in the 17th century, people didn't consider English as good as Latin. So that was sort of at that stage, and I thought of it as gestural. I think I thought of it as kind of a substitute, a pidgin, not really a language. And that's why I was so interested in this other really burnished language that there was poetry and theater and drama. And I didn't understand, as I do now, that there's wonderful theater and great poetry in sign language. And I think that's been the wonderful, remarkable discoveries of the last 10 or 15 years.
You mentioned people staring at you on the subway. Kids can be really cruel. Did they give you, did kids, your peers, give you a hard time about your parents?
No, you know, except for the kid who said my father talked like a Native American. Not really. I mean, I grew up in a pretty working class neighborhood. Everybody knew my parents. I mean, they didn't treat my parents particularly different. In fact, it was the kind of neighborhood you kind of ignored the parents and you just kind of went with the kids. And I actually spent a lot of time teaching all my friends how to do fingerspelling, so that sort of made me feel kind of special. Aside from when, like, my mother would come to school, there wasn't really a lot of interaction. My parents pretty much stayed to themselves and let me have a lot of freedom, which was good and bad.
Leonard Davis's memoir is My Sense of Silence. We spoke last year. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a deaf father's obsession with television. We continue our conversation with Leonard Davis about his memoir, My Sense of Silence. Also, David Bianculli reviews the season opener of The Sopranos, and Henry Sheehan reviews The Mexican. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue our interview with Leonard Davis, recorded last spring. He's the author of a memoir, My Sense of Silence, about growing up the son of deaf parents in the South Bronx in the 50s. He also edited a book of his parents' love letters called Shall I Say Kiss? Davis's parents were working-class Jews who emigrated from England. How did your father, your mother, support the family?
My father was a sewing machine operator in the garment district, and my mother was an alteration hand. When I was a kid, she took in people came to our house, and she fixed their clothing. She altered them. She made clothing. And my father was a seasonal worker, so he wasn't working for about half the year, and most of the time he was home, sort of grumpy, and you know, reading the daily news and criticizing everybody and falling asleep on the couch. And my mother was. It was kind of odd for me because there was a steady stream of women who would come into our living room, take their clothes off, and then you know my mother would sort of tend to get on her knees and sort of fix their clothing. I found this kind of interesting, actually.
I bet. was tailoring a common occupation for deaf people? I can't imagine there were all that many occupations open to them.
Yes, tailoring was one. Particularly the sewing machine operators were good because they weren't disturbed by the noise. The classic deaf occupation was linotyper, because you could work for the newspapers, you could have this deafening noise and it wouldn't bother you, and you know your reading skills and so on were not involved with your deafness. But my father always wanted to get into like linotype or the plumbers union or something, but he ended up always being this sewing machine operator, and it was kind of he was sort of proud about his work, but I think on some level he would have liked to have done better.
You write in your memoir that television was just this towering presence in your house, that your father was extremely controlling about the use of and the treatment of and the handling of the television. What were some of his rules about it?
Oh, the TV. The deal in my house, it was sort of a Hobson's choice that was given to my brother. And my parents said, do you want a brother or do you want a TV set? This was in 1949. My brother, to his credit, said he wanted a brother. But, you know, as soon as I showed up, I turned out to be rather boring in the beginning. So he wanted a TV set. So they got one in 1950. And this was this wonderful Emerson console, you know, this kind of mahogany monolith that stood in our living room, and my father he instantly became a devotee, and it was like this thing was like his god. And he loved watching baseball, which he could do without hearing. The TV set he was so terrified of it. It was also breaking all the time. So we had all these rules, like, you know, you never allowed to touch the little box in the front of it that had the horizontal and vertical controls. And you have to, every time you turn the channel, you had to take your hand off so that the TV would have a chance to rest. I mean, these were kind of invented things, but to placate the god of the television. But he was very insistent about it. And also, if you turn the TV set off, you have to wait 10 minutes before you turn it on again so that it wouldn't get upset. And of course, I ended up doing all the things I wasn't supposed to do and breaking the TV set and constantly having to have it shipped off. So anytime the TV set broke, it was my fault by definition.
Because you were the youngest.
I was the youngest and therefore the least likely to follow orders.
Leonard, when you edited these letters, that was from a period of courtship when your mother was still in England and your father was already in America and they were separated for 2 years. How did you get access to the letters?
Well, when my father died, I went to his apartment and I found them, and they were this neat little package of letters. And it was one of these things that, you know, you see in the movies where somebody opens up this little package and you read the first letter, and I got completely sucked into it. They're absolutely in order. They're mostly my mother's letters to him from the period of 1936 to 38. And it was fascinating. I literally entered into this courtship that they were having with each other when they were, you know, younger than I was when I read it at that point, and or at least my mother was. It was a kind of page turner. I mean, and periodically they would break up and they'd have fights, and suddenly I would begin to feel myself sort of disappearing. You know, it was sort of the Back to the Future moment where I began to get faint every time that they would fight with each other. And the last letter is my mother saying, you know, I'm coming over, I'm getting on the boat, I'm coming over, and that was the last letter.
What did you learn from them, from the letters, about your parents that you hadn't known or you couldn't have known as a kid?
Well, the thing that I think was the most dramatic for me was that my mother, when I was growing up, my mother was kind of this quiet, sort of you could say depressed, you could say zen kind of presence in the house. I mean, she was sort of the submissive wife, and occasionally she'd fight with my father, but, you know, usually he would win. And it was, she was kind of quiet. He was always supposed to be the great writer. You know, he had this column in the Deaf newspaper, and he wrote plays and things. And my mother was supposed to be sort of the less educated one. Well, you look at the letters. She writes these fabulous letters, very strong, very powerful, a woman who really knows what she wants. I mean, my father, they had only met each other three or four times when my father had to leave England because his visa ran out. And he, right at the third or fourth time, he said he wanted her to come to America. He wanted to marry her. And the letters are all about her saying, well, I don't know who you are and what is this all about, and I do love you, but this is a big jump, and, you know, how can you say such things? And it was just this kind of well-written, clear, direct writing. That was a big surprise for me about my mother. And my father was this kind of, like, you know, on his knees kind of wooer, you know, just totally crazy about her and begging her to do all these kind of things that seem pretty impulsive.
So, and both those things seem so out of character for them.
Well, my father always was in love with my mother, but just to see him as this sort of, you know, love-struck guy, yeah, that was kind of interesting too.
You are involved with an organization called Children of Deaf Adults, CODA. And at a meeting of CODA, you once hired actors to read from the letters, and you invited your brother to attend and to hear this. I can't imagine what that must be like to hear, to have both of you hear your parents really given voice. Did it ring true to you, or was it jarring?
Oh, no, it was incredible. It was one of the most amazing experiences. The two actors were themselves CODAs. And then we set it up the way that Love Letters play is, where they were sitting at a table, and behind them were two people who would be signing what they were actually voicing. So you had both signing and voicing. And we made the letters have a kind of structure to them. And it was incredible. The audience reacted. There were about 300 or 400 people in the audience, and they just reacted so positively, and they were so interested in it that it was an amazing vindication for me, because my parents were, you know, they were working class deaf people. I mean, who could be lower on the totem pole? And here was this occasion where their letters were being performed, and people were really thinking of them as a kind of an, you know, interesting story, well written, and even the fact that the letters were published by Gallaudet University Press, and their letters are now going to be in the archive of that library, would have been such an honor for them. Plus, they also would have been completely mystified. I mean, I'm sure if they were alive, they wouldn't have wanted the letters to be published.
Leonard Davis's memoir is My Sense of Silence. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're featuring an interview recorded last spring with Leonard Davis, author of a memoir of growing up the son of deaf parents, called My Sense of Silence. When you do think of your parents, do you hear them talking to you, or do you see them signing to you?
Both.
Mm-hmm. And talking in their original voices, or in voices of more fluency that you've internalized in?
No, I kind of feel that in the original voice. I wish I had recordings of them. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily think you'd want to record a deaf person, but I'd love to hear their voices now. I do miss them. They're both dead.
I thought it was interesting that in translating their signing or their speech and your signing in this book, My Sense of Silence, that you didn't turn the words, the language into English, that you left out connecting words like articles. In deaf culture, is there an accepted etiquette to how you're supposed to translate signing? Not to Englishify it, or, I don't know, make it more verbal?
Well, that's a good point, good question. And when I first started writing about it, I was talking to somebody who was an interpreter, and they said, please don't do this thing where you make them come across as sounding illiterate, because, you know, if they were speaking in sign language, they wouldn't be illiterate. It would be flowing. But I felt that that to really capture them, since they also did speak, I had to give this sort of way that they spoke. I had to try to characterize the way that they spoke. And, I mean, there's a book that somebody recently wrote called Train Go Sorry, which is a literal translation of an expression in sign language that means, like, you missed the boat. But to say you missed the boat would miss the nice way that that is formed. Train, go. Sorry, you know. Mm. And there's also something called CODA talk, which developed spontaneously in the CODA conferences. And a lot of people talk that way to each other in the conference, just to sort of, because sign language belongs to the deaf, and English belongs to the hearing, let's say spoken English. And so we, CODAs, don't have a language. And so CODA talk came about as a kind of a language that we could express ourselves in. And people actually write poems in it.
Now, you became an academic. You're also a writer of cultural criticism. You teach English. And all of these jobs are a form of translation in some way, of interpreting culture, interpreting books for your students, helping them. Do you see a continuity between the role you played for your parents and your chosen profession?
Oh, absolutely. Although I didn't see it right away. In fact, the funny thing was that for me, I was a poor kid from the Bronx. I got a scholarship from my parents' union and also from Columbia. And I went to Columbia College and I went to Columbia University and I studied with all these sort of famous people. And I thought, I'm going to move into this world of refined language and, I'm going to be doing something about as different as I possibly could from growing up in a deaf family in the Bronx. And then it hit me at some point that actually what I'm doing is I'm an interpreter of texts, and I'm interpreting and even as a writer, you're interpreting your ideas, you're putting them in the best possible language, you're thinking about how to say this in the right way. So in some sense, it's what I've always been doing, and I'm pretty comfortable doing it.
Your father is dead. Both your parents are dead, but your father did live long enough to see you established in your career, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your mother died, though, I think when you were in college.
Yes.
In a car accident.
Well, she died what I consider the death of a deaf person. I mean, she was coming from the deaf club on 14th Street, and she was going to get a sandwich. It was about 6 o'clock at night, and she crossed the street, and the light changed, and some car came barreling along and honked, assuming that she would hear, and that she didn't, and she was killed. I was 22. It was pretty traumatic.
And that's common, I guess.
Well, deafness is an invisible disability. You wouldn't assume that people walking along the street are deaf if you were driving your car and you honked.
Right.
But maybe you should.
I'm curious if silence is important for you in your life, that you somehow absorbed some of your parents' silence. Although it doesn't sound like they were very silent, but I imagine there were hours and there were days when there was much more silence in your house than in others.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing to just clear up is that a lot of people think that to be deaf is to be silent, but deaf people are fill up the space, not only with sign language, but also with even noises. And there are deaf noises that are sort of communicative in a way, and slapping hands and, other kinds of sound. But yes, I spent a lot of time with complete silence. My father used to watch the TV with the sound off. And I don't know if you're aware of what a TV sounds like with the sound off, but there's this kind of high-pitched hum, which I really got to like as a kid. And but that's almost kind of like a sound of silence. And I spend a lot of time thinking about silence even now, and kind of find myself wanting to be in a completely quiet environment and then also sort of hating it. So I'm ambivalent, I guess. And but I haven't figured out silence yet. I'm still working on it.
Leonard Davis, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, I'm delighted to talk to you.
Leonard Davis's memoir is My Sense of Silence. We spoke last spring. He has a new novel, The Sonnets, due out in April. Hollywood superstars Julia Roberts and Brad Pitt star in the new comedy, The Mexican. James Gandolfini, the mob boss from the TV show The Sopranos, plays a lovable hitman. Film critic Henry Sheehan says Gandolfini's character steals the movie.
Let's face it. The days when high-wattage stars like Marlene Dietrich and Gary Cooper teamed up for romantic romps are long gone. In the 21st century, you get Julia Roberts and Brad Pitt. Or at least the Mexican's advertising makes you think you do. Actually, this comedy criminal escapade puts the two leads together for a few minutes at the movie's beginning and a few more at the end. And that's just misstep number one. The Mexican turns out to be one of those movies that leaves you frustrated over Hollywood's inability to put together a simple piece of entertaining fluff. Pitt plays a laid-back Angelino named Jerry, who is coming to the end of an enforced 5-year tenure as a mob errand boy. Roberts, as Jerry's girlfriend Samantha, has been putting up with Jerry's job under adamant protest. When she discovers that Jerry has been pressed into one more job, she hits the roof and the road. While Jerry heads south for Mexico, Samantha cuts their ties and leaves for Vegas. Jerry is going to Mexico because his mob boss wants him to pick up a priceless, gold-encrusted antique pistol called the Mexican. Typically, Jerry bungles the pickup and has to retrieve the pistol from some thieves. Here, Jerry tries to deal with the chief thief in what he thinks is an appropriate, tough guy manner.
I'm not going to kill you. But I'm going to have to shoot you.
But why, sir? Why?
Why? Why? Because you stole from me. And you know about the pistol, and you're just going to steal again, and I can't have you coming back in this situation like a fly in the ointment.
No, I won't be a fly. You'll never see me again.
You're getting shot, and that's it. It'll take you time to get to the next town, especially if you're limping.
Wait. Limping? Can't you just tie me up some more? I mean, you shoot me? Tie me!
Yeah, I don't have a rope.
So you shoot me?
It's the American way. Now, where do you want it? Okay.
No, not the leg, those arteries. I could bleed to death in mere seconds.
The foot, then.
Jerry has taken so long performing a simple task that his bosses think he might have stolen the pistol for himself. As insurance against that possibility, they have Samantha taken hostage by a professional hitman who is named Leroy and played by James Gandolfini. Leroy is the most intriguing character in the movie, but also the most symptomatic of the movie's failings. Underneath the killer's cold professionalism, Leroy turns out to be a sensitive guy who ends up having long, heartfelt conversations with Samantha about the vicissitudes of love. Gandolfini could probably play this type in his sleep, but to his credit, he doesn't. On the contrary, he gives the most emotionally affecting performance in the movie. Yet Leroy turns out to be an utterly inconsistent figure, cold-blooded and ruthless one minute, puppy dog cuddly the next. That could be a sign of psychosis, and the movie suggests he's an outright nut at one point, but it's also typical of the movie's inability to maintain a single mood or characterization. Leroy becomes the center of increasingly violent and graphic crimes, culminating in a shocking murder. But moments after the murder, everyone involved shrugs it off and proceeds as if it had never happened. There are other outbreaks of collective amnesia. During Pitt's Mexican foray, 3 whole characters and a good-sized subplot simply vanish without explanation and without anyone else seeming to notice. That's what happens when you apply a TV commercial mentality to movie making. Director Gore Verbinski's only previous feature was The Great Mouse Hunt, but his resume is filled with successful commercial productions. Verbinski's attention span isn't quite limited to 30 seconds, but it doesn't seem to extend much longer than that either. Roberts has long ceased being the pink-sweatered mannequin she used to be. Here, she can be wonderful, especially when she's with Gandolfini. The closest the film ever comes to real drama is in the scenes they have together. Pitt is a far less accomplished actor, but he's a better performer than he was even a couple of years ago. He hasn't overcome his centerfold-style narcissism, but at least he's been able to integrate it into his character. If you're into stargazing, even with intermittent clouds, you could do worse than check out The Mexican. Just don't expect a whole constellation.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Coming up, a review of the season opener of The Sopranos. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. This Sunday, after a very long wait, fans of the HBO series The Sopranos finally get to watch some new episodes. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
The second season of The Sopranos ended with New Jersey mob boss Tony Soprano, played by James Gandolfini, feverish from food poisoning. He dreamed about a talking fish, a fish that spoke with the voice of his close buddy Big Pussy, who admitted of being a turncoat for the feds. When Tony woke up, he found out the dream was correct. Before the episode was over, Big Pussy wasn't talking with the fishes, he was sleeping with them. Also, Tony was arrested for passing on stolen airline tickets to his own mother, played by Nancy Marchand. The show ended with a scene at his daughter's graduation party. Tony was led away in handcuffs, promising he'd be back in a couple of hours. That was 11 months ago. There hasn't been an original first-run episode of The Sopranos since April of last year. And during the hiatus, Marchand, whose evil matriarch Livia Soprano was a key part of the show, died. Clearly, series creator David Chase had some work to do. He's done it brilliantly. Sunday night, HBO presents the first two episodes of the show's third season. Tony is out of jail and back in charge. Livia is still alive, but not for very long. Tony's wife Carmela, played by Edie Falco, is trying to keep the family unit intact, even though their daughter Meadow, played by Jamie Lynn Sigler, has left for college at Columbia. And while life as a mob boss is tricky enough, most of Tony's energies in these early episodes are directed to dealing with personal issues. There's his relationship with his mother, his increasingly distant relationships with his teenage kids, and, in one intense confrontation that brings to the surface the more reprehensible side of Tony's personality, his private conversation with his daughter's new boyfriend from college, whom he's meeting for the first time.
So you guys, you and Meadow, are you,
A little early to say.
What's your background, Noel?
Noah. I'm from Los Angeles, West L.A.
No, what I mean is,
My family's in the business. I mean, show business. I don't know why they call it the business.
Those old Tarzan movies?
My dad's an entertainment lawyer.
No, what I mean is, like, we're Italian.
Oh, my dad is Jewish and my mother's family is African-American.
Tannenbaum, right. But on your application to Columbia, you didn't check Jewish, did you?
No, they can't ask about religious affiliation.
All right, right. Of course. What'd you check?
African-American.
So we do understand each other here. You're Ditsum.
Excuse me?
Charcoal briquette, a moulignon.
What's your problem?
I think you know what my problem is. You see, your little friend up there, she didn't do you any favors bringing you into this house. Now, I don't know what the she was thinking. We'll get to that later. See, I got business associates who are black, and they don't want my son with their daughters, and I don't want their sons with mine.
You.
See, that's the kind of thing I'm hoping to avoid. So when my little girl comes down the stairs, you're gonna say how nice it was to meet me. Then you're gonna go drop her off at school and you're gonna say goodbye.
Come on, if you wanna see the Garden State. We're gonna drop by Hunter's. I wanna meet Nella, then we'll be back to pick up my laundry. Later, Dad.
Based on four episodes provided for preview, this third season of The Sopranos is as good as the first, which means it's about as good as TV gets. The death of Livia turns out to provide the show with lots of terrific sparks and plot twists. The post-funeral service is outrageously angry. Tony gets more serious about therapy to deal with how good he feels about his mother's death. And Janice, Tony's loose cannon sister, returns for the funeral. Also, new characters are introduced, the best of which is Joe Pantoliano from Easy Streets, as a gangster with an attitude so bad, he makes Tony look civilized. The point of The Sopranos, of course, is that these people aren't civilized. We care about them as characters and even like them. Then, when they turn around and do something horrific, the shock and revulsion are that much more uncomfortable. These aren't people we love to hate. The more we get to know them, these are people we hate to love. On every level, the show is a true treat. The entire cast is marvelous, and Chase does some stuff that's just flat-out fun to watch. In one scene in Sunday's third season opener, he stages a long sequence where federal agents tail every member of the Soprano family, chasing them around streets and dorms and strip clubs in hopes of finding a time when the house is empty so they can plant a bug. The scene already has energy to spare, but Chase ups the ante by setting it to two brilliantly merged pieces of music. One is the theme to Peter Gunn, the other is Every Breath You Take by the Police. It's the little touches like that, as much as the operatic characters and plots, that make The Sopranos worth the wait, even after 11 months.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. The Sopranos season opener airs Sunday night on HBO. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
She's leaving the court.
Bingo's leaving the Bing, too.
This does not look good, Mrs. Bing, bearing north on Grandview Avenue. She's turned onto Boxwood Road. She's heading toward the factory.
Abort. Repeat. Abort. SC team, get the hell out of there now.
Abort, Andy. It's not a go. Repeat. We are not a go.
Must be a crisis with one of the children.
Control, I placed Baby Bing in the school building.
Unit 5, report.
That's a big Roger from this end, too. She went into her room about 2 minutes ago. I heard her tell a friend she was going to get some sleep.
Think anybody made us?
I don't know. But we're finished for today here, ladies and gentlemen.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated Style Press Division, publisher of Mary and O'Neill, a novel and stories by debut author Justin Cronin. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
When the first U.S. astronauts were launched into space and later landed on the moon, Chris Kraft was back on Earth directing them. On the next Fresh Air, we meet Chris Kraft, the first NASA flight director and creator of Mission Control. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.